This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Again, and he's got it!
Gavin was closing in. Oh, Gavin has scored!
Abdul Osman against Brad Jones to put Liverpool out of the cup and Northampton 3!
Yes!
Northampton have got it!
Hello everyone and welcome to a very special It's All Cobblers to Me bonus episode. This Sunday, a whole load of Cobblers legends are going head to head in a Legends Day at Sixfields. And so we thought we'd invite one of them onto the podcast to have a chat about their career and their time at the club. With nearly 200 appearances for the Cobblers to his name, as well as being one of those heroes of Anfield of 2010, there is no doubt that the word legend is appropriate for the man joining us now. Please welcome to It's All Cobblers to Me, Andy Holt. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Yeah, good. We were just saying before, and we both come on brand, dressed in claret. We're ready for Sunday.
Yeah.
All good. What is it you're doing these days just to catch everyone up?
So yeah, I'm a client relationship manager for a tech recruitment company. So I was saying pretty much since I finished football, I got into business development where I could go out and meet clients, which is what I love doing and been doing that for 11 years now.
Nice. Good stuff. I wanted to go back, basically start your career first. We'll talk mainly about your time at the Cobblers, but I wanted to start by talking about the one of the big things that you were known for really as a player, the long throw. Neil was asking, one of our other podcasters was asking me to ask you if you could throw a trainer over a house. But as well as that, what's the long throw? Is that something that comes naturally to you? Or how did you find out that you had that in your locker? Was it just one day you just took a throw in and it just flew across the pitch? Or what happened?
It did come naturally. It's not something that I ever felt that I needed to practice. It's not like I'd stay behind and do repetitions of long throws for however long. It just seemed to come. I think from an early age, I remember listening to a different podcast not that long ago about someone was speaking about Rory Delap, and they didn't know that he had a long throw, and they just said, let's do a long throw competition. And he's got the ability to get his arms further back, some not double jointed, but could just launch a ball, and it always seemed to be the case. And then obviously from there, even from a young age, I'd be taking the throw-ins from everywhere on the pitch just to try and get it as far down the line as possible or into the box like a corner.
Nice. And that's something you've picked up quite young, is it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I remember being... I was always very tall. Even I look at the school photos from when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, I wasn't that far short of as high as the teacher. And I looked like I was one of the illegal children who was like, he's never that age. He can't be, because all the other kids were a lot smaller. So I always seemed to be, I think by the time I was 13 or 14, I was as tall as I am now. So I always stood out that way. And I played left wing, which wasn't really, everyone just presumed I'd be a centre half. And again, I think I just took throw-ins and it became, came natural, and that's where I got it from.
Nice. Good stuff. We'll circle back to the Cobblers in a bit, but starting off your career, you started off coming through the academy at Oldham. Can you tell us a little bit about your time breaking through there and getting into the first team?
Yeah, it was brilliant, to be fair. And I'm still in touch with quite a lot of the lads because we had a really good group from, I think, 14 to about 18. We had a similar set of lads. So you get through the YTS days, and I think nowadays you might get one that will sign pro, maybe two. We had 12 from our year that signed professional contracts that went to playing in the first team, which is unheard of, really. So a really good group of lads that were playing for a couple of years. We had a really decent youth team. And again, even some of the senior pros that were there when I broke into the first team, I still speak to them. We met up not that long ago at Oldham, which was brilliant. And it was good to see them and see how they're getting on. And again, I think just having a really good set of senior pros around you when you as a young kid to teach you discipline, to teach you that you come in first and you leave last, all them kind of things, I think was a really good setting for us and stood us in good stead.
And this is a very different Oldham to the one we see now, obviously, for younger listeners. This is an Oldham we were just coming out of their time in the Premier League, essentially, wasn't it? And they've had a really good run to the FA Cup semi-finals in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Obviously, so different to where they are now. Such big troubles that have happened there. But at the time when you're coming through, would they have been in Division One, sort of the equivalent to Championship at that point?
Yeah, they're in the Championship, and then went down to League One. But yeah, it was brilliant. Again, we had some really strong character senior players. Andy Ritchie was playing. Graham Sharp was playing. Darren Beckford and the like. So they were the ones where, again, things are a little different now. So we had to be in at 8 o'clock in the morning to clean the showers, clean the toilets, clean the bathrooms, get all the kit out for your first team pro, get the boots cleaned, etc. And I don't think that kind of thing happens nowadays as much, or it didn't even towards the end of my career at the Cobblers, where again it just keeps you grounded, keeps you disciplined. And even after training, we'd have to clear all the kits away, clean all the boots again after training, all the cleaning of the showers, etc. So it was a very disciplined lifestyle, which is great. I look at it now, and even now if my kids are anywhere near being late, I'm like, you cannot be late. Even if you're on time, we're late. We need to be 5 minutes early. And I think that obviously drives them a little bit mad, but that's just what has been instilled. So yeah, it was a great club. It was a shame. I think a few clubs have fallen by the wayside that were, you know, in the dizzy heights of the Premier League. So yeah, it's a big fall from grace and a shame, really.
Mm, definitely is. Hopefully they'll be on their way back eventually. Same as the likes of Bury. Rochdale have had troubles recently and things like that. It all seems to be sort of clubs in the north of England. And sometimes it's baffling, isn't it, when you've got teams down the road who are billionaires and you've got all that going on just miles from the likes of Bury and Oldham and Rochdale that this kind of thing can happen to clubs.
Yeah, I think that the problem is that I don't think it's appealing enough to become an owner of a football club. Obviously, with Wrexham, my former club, where the billionaires are now, the turnaround is incredible. I obviously go back to a few games there, and I've seen the change. It used to be a case where we'd meet outside the ground at 12 o'clock and it'd be deadly quiet. You'd be able to get as many tickets for your family, and then you'd go into the stands, and even in the boxes where you do talks to the fans, it'd be full sometimes, whereas now you arrive at 12 o'clock, 3 hours before the kickoff, everywhere around the ground is absolutely buzzing. So it's brilliant for Wrexham, and it's just a shame that more clubs can't get taken over by these billionaires just to get money back into the city and the town and get more investment there.
Yeah, definitely. So am I right in saying that one of your first games for Oldham was actually at Sixfields when you're breaking through?
I remember it must have been, I'm trying to think when Sixfields, what year would Sixfields have opened? Was it 2000?
No, Sixfields was 94, 95.
Oh, was it that early? Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, one of my first games I remember, because we played, and again, I was only a young kid at the time, 17, 18. And I remember playing at Northampton because the senior pros used to say, we need to wear our tin hats. And I'm like, I've no idea what that means. And then when you had a corner or a free kick or a throw-in or anything, I knew exactly what it meant, because there was like 4 or 5 6-foot-plus players stood on the keeper, grabbing you, pushing you. And I'm like, wow, this is a real wake-up call to men's football. So yeah, I remember that. I didn't realise it was that. I tried to be hopeful saying it was 2000, but it was obviously quite a few years before then.
Yeah, I've got 98 here on my list. I'm not sure how far these records would go back, but one of them people would have been Samo jumping all over you, wouldn't he, as well, at that
probably,
point?
Yeah. Probably. I remember Samo, yeah. So it would have been.
And that's the Cobblers under Ian Atkins, which was known for sort of that kind of football. It's get your corners, get your free kicks, and get yeah. under you. So So you move on from Oldham, you then go to Hull. I think you had a loan spell there first, didn't you, and then signed permanently. Basically, right at the start of their rise up the leagues, wasn't it? You had a really good first season there, then get sent out on loan to Barnsley and Shrewsbury. Was that what kind of went on there in the middle? Because you started off quite well at Hull. Was it just change of management that the new manager came in and wanted you to go on loan instead?
Yeah, it was a shame. I look back at my time at Hull very fondly, and yet it ended not the way I would like it to. So I remember I was at Oldham not playing as much in the first team. And then I think my agent rang and said, Aberdeen want to sign you. And so did Hull. And obviously Oldham were in League One at the time, Hull were in League Two. And I was thinking, it's a bit far to go up to Scotland with having just, getting married, getting a young family. And I thought I'd go to Hull. I didn't realise how big Hull was. And I think it was the first game we played was at Boothby Park and they played Exeter. So I didn't expect many fans to be there because Exeter obviously miles and miles away. And I think there's about 16,000. And I was like, wow, this is such a huge city. So went there on loan and didn't lose a game until we got to the playoff semi-final against Leyton Orient. And I remember the fullback just absolutely munched me on my ankle and I came off and I was on crutches and didn't finish the game. And that was the first game we lost, which was a shame because it'd have been nice to get promoted. But then the next season, we had obviously Brian Little in there. And then towards the end of that, he left and I think Jan Molby came in for a very brief period. And that was an interesting time. And then we had Peter Taylor. So Peter Taylor came in and he said straight away, you're not in my plans. And I was like, fine, that's fair enough. So weirdly enough, I came out to Northampton. Richard Hill and I can't think of the manager was called at the time. Wilkinson, maybe?
Martin Wilkinson. Yeah.
Thank you. So I remember driving down and I trained with the first team and then I was like, this is a bit weird. I've not, because my agent was saying, you know, you've got a contract sorted. I was like, yeah, that's fine. And there was a game that night. So I remember pulling Richard Hill going, oh, I believe I need to sign my contract because obviously I don't want to get injured. And then he went, oh, there's no contract. You've come down on trial. And I was like, I've come down on trial. I was like, why would I come down on trial? So I ended up ringing Peter Taylor, who's the manager at Hull. And he went, get back in the car and drive back up. I don't know what's going on there. So ended up going back to Hull. And then Peter Taylor said, listen, you need to get your head down. So I got my head down and worked my way back into the first team and played quite a few games in the promotion season. And then it was a case that he pulled me and said, you're going to get a new contract. You know, I've changed my mind on you. I was like, brilliant. And then at the end, he just said, oh, I can't give you that contract. At the end of the season, after we'd had our promotion party, been away. So I was like, it was really gut-wrenching to think you're going to be there for another 2 years. And the club's obviously going, we'd moved to the KC Stadium and everything was going in the right direction. Then it was just like a hammer blow going, well, that's it now. I don't know what I'm going to do. So yeah, it was an interesting time.
Yeah, so then you're off to Wrexham 2004. Very different club, like we mentioned earlier, to the one we see these days in terms of the infrastructure around it, all the hoopla that comes, the Hollywood stuff that comes around it. One of the things you did there, you won the Football League trophy, but you won it while sort of there was a period of Wembley being rebuilt and all the games, all the finals were being played at the Millennium Stadium. Yeah. Was that a motivation for Wrexham to go and get a final in Wales? Was that part of, and how special was that to go and play a final in sort of the new, at the time, I guess, the new build massive stadium, the National Stadium in Wales for Wrexham?
Absolutely. I mean, in the semi-final, we played Oldham, so my old team, and it was strange playing against them. And we obviously got through to the final. And the fact it was at the Millennium made it all that bit more special. So it was such a weird season because we were obviously going into administration. The club financially was on its knees. I remember playing a game, I can't remember if it was before the final, after the final, where they had, his name was Alex Hamilton, I think, the chairman. And you never really hear the crowd. And during one game, we just heard some disturbance. I didn't know what was going on. Then we found out afterwards that during the game, he went into the home fans' end to try and talk to them and explain his decision. And I was like, that is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard in my life. So, yeah, the game got stopped and I think he had to get taken away, obviously, because the fans were fuming. But I remember it was a case that we would only get paid after games. It was you didn't know whether we were going to get paid or not. It was such a different time to where it is now. So to be able to go to the Millennium, and we spent a couple of days down there, I think it was the Vale of Glamorgan Hotel, and just, it was such a, I remember the game being quite drab, quite boring, but it was a beautiful, beautiful day. And we had Ben Foster in goal, and obviously Darren Ferguson was playing in midfield. So we won, and afterwards we're in the change room just soaking it all in. And then Sir Alex walks in and walks around and shakes everyone's hand, and you're there going, I've only had one Budweiser, but I'm pretty sure that's Sir Alex Ferguson. And, yeah. And on the back of that, he signed Ben Foster for Man United. I mean, Ben was one of the best goalkeepers I've ever seen, so I wasn't surprised that he went on to do so well. But yeah, it was a really special day, and I managed to get a lot of the family down, even though it made them, I'm sure they would. I wanted to play at Wembley. I always wanted to play at Wembley, but still, to play at the Millennium, it was such a magnificent stadium. It was just a brilliant, brilliant day.
And you're a Man United fan as well, aren't you? So
yeah, I used to be quite proud of saying that, whereas now I keep my head down as much as possible. But no, yeah, to see Sir Alex Ferguson come in, it was just incredible. And so yeah, it was a brilliant, brilliant day.
Yeah. Was there any pressure in playing with his son as well at the time? But you,
oh, no, knowing no. That. No, because he just whinged, honestly. Darren Ferguson whinged for fun. He was brilliant, technically brilliant player. And to be fair, there was a few of us lived over Manchester way. So me and Darren, Jim Whitley, and that would drive in every day. So I got to know Darren really well. And he was like just a lovely, lovely lad when he wasn't so miserable and whinging at you on the football pitch. Getting for a beer, brilliant. But even in training, he's just one of those. There's a few that I've met through my career who just whinge. And then, to be fair, I'm sure his dad was very much the same, just expecting perfection on everything. So, yeah, it was something I got used to.
Yeah, we'll leave Darren Ferguson there after this week, especially. We don't want to bring him up too much this week. So Cobblers then come calling in 2006 then. I read a great story about the move in that Colin Calderwood was the Cobblers manager at the time. He was just about to move on. John Gorman at the time was at Wickham.
Yep.
Both of you, I read that both of them wanted you for the Cobblers and for Wickham. Colin then moved on to Nottingham Forest at the end of the season. John moves to the Cobblers, and then John gives you a call and says, I still want you, but I want you at Northampton now. How did all that occur?
That's pretty much Bob on. I remember being... I think I was in Altrincham watching my son play football at school. He was only probably five, six at the time. And I remember getting a call off Colin saying, you know, what bring you down to Northampton? I was like, yeah, no problems. And this was on, I'm presuming it was a Friday. And then obviously John gave me a call afterwards and saying he's at Wickham, wants me to come down and sign. I was like, yeah, okay, no worries. So I had the weekend to think a bit on it. And then by the time Monday had come round, Colin had left Nottingham to go to Nottingham Forest, and John had come in at the Cobblers, and he went, I still want to see you. Do you want to come down? Here's my plan for you moving forward. So I went to see John, and to be fair, a lovely, lovely, lovely man. I had a talk with him, and I was like, yeah, I really want to. Straight away in the first meeting, he's going, I see you playing as a wing back or left back, and I want you bombing forward. Here's the system we're looking to play. I was like, wow, this sounds really good. I like that. Yeah, and then from there, I just signed.
I mean, John, like you said, John, from the outside anyway, always struck me as one of the nicest men in football. Would that be quite accurate?
Absolutely bang on. He was just so... I remember when I had Brian Little at Hull, and people talk about the best manager you've ever had. And I've had Neil Warnock. Neil Warnock was my manager at Oldham, and the contrast is unbelievable, as you can probably imagine. But with John, it was just, he never needed to raise his voice. He never needed to shout at us. He was always one of those that would put an arm around you and say, we're doing okay. Everything's okay. So yeah, just a fantastic, fantastic bloke.
Yeah, and Brian Little seems to be, watching from the outside again only, but seems to be that kind of character as well, as if, like, you know, he walks into a room, everything goes quiet, but what he says has a lot of power. Is that kind of similar to what John was like?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was at, when I first signed for Hull on loan, he had some big characters like John Whitney, you had Gary Brabin, like big Kevin Francis, people like that in the dressing room. And if we were arguing at whatever stage at half time, and then as soon as the gaffer walked in, everyone stopped talking and listened to him. And he just said the most calming things. If it was nil-nil, and obviously you're at home and you're expected to win, he'd like, don't be embarrassed at nil-nil. It's okay. We're not losing. It's nil-nil. We're still in the game. And everyone just kind of calmed down and then get ready to go back out. So yeah, Brian and John were very similar in their demeanour and the way they were. And it absolutely worked.
Yeah. And what is it about managers when they're like that and they have that kind of sort of sense of calm and peace throughout? What is it about them that strikes not a fear, but strikes that into such big characters in the dressing room and makes them suddenly fall quiet? Because I can't think that that's an easy thing to do.
No, I don't think it would be. And I think you look at it and go, the way they were, I think because of previously through their career, they've been so successful. You look at it and go, this is why when they come in, you expect what they're going to say is pretty bob on, and they've been there, worn the T-shirt and done it before. So I think just, again, through what they've done in the game, they've earned that respect. So even though we might be quarrelling over passing to the wrong player or whatever it is, this is more important. The manager's more important. He knows his stuff. He's not going to single anyone out and start having a go at them. It's all for the team, and I think that's where the respect came from.
So John leaves that Christmas, quite sad circumstances around him leaving, obviously a difficult time for the team. Did you all feel that at the time, and sort of how much did that hit the squad, and how much did you know about what was going on and everything like that?
Yeah, it was just sadness. Obviously, I knew before that he'd left Wickham at the time when his wife had passed, and it was obviously difficult. I remember speaking to him when he was interested in signing me at Wickham, and he said he's got to go back in and speak to them about making sure he's okay. And then obviously it didn't come to fruition and ended up at Northampton. But like I said, I remember the first game of the season, my debut, we played Crewe at Crewe. And we're in the change rooms, and he used to put on the speech from the Al Pacino speech, where it's every 6 inches count. I can't remember the film. Any Given Sunday. He loved that speech, and he would put it on the change rooms. And then I remember we were outside, and James Blunt came on, "You're Beautiful." And he was just stood there. The gaffer was just stood there holding his heart, looking up. So he was obviously thinking of his wife. Yeah. And I was like, it's so sad. It sticks in my mind. It's my debut. I want to obviously try and focus on the game. You're looking, going, he must have so many other things going through his mind. So, again, just an absolute gentleman, and so sad, really, the way things happened. And I just don't think he was ready to move on that quickly and get back into management, and was it all worth it? So it was a shame, and we knew what was going on, so just a sad time.
Yeah, definitely such a good guy as well, not that it makes it any more easier to cope with, but just a really, you just really feel it, don't you? And especially, I must imagine, as players, we've had a lot of stuff over the last couple of years at the Cobblers that have gone on behind the scenes that none of us would have known about at the time. So as players, it must have just been really difficult to deal with.
Yeah, of course.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So Stuart Gray comes in, kickstarts a really successful time for the club with a team that I think a lot of us think as fans, if it would have been kept together a little bit longer, it really would have challenged for promotion from League One. Did you get a sense when he came in and he started building this squad, there was quite a lot of young players coming through? Did you get a sense early that something special might have been building there?
I think so, because new managers always come in and they always go, "You're not fit enough, I'm going to get you fit," and all that. And everyone, it's just like, they've got a manual saying this is what they need to say. Yeah. But with the gaffer, with Stuart, he was bob on, I think, in the way that he was going, if we're super fit, then mindset-wise, if it comes 80, 85, 90, 95 minutes, we're still going to be mentally switched on enough to be in control of games. And I remember doing a pre-season where let's say we started on the 1st of July, which is normally the time we would start back pre-season. The gaffer gave us a programme that started on the 1st of June. So we would, by the time we came into the 1st of July, we already needed to be at a really good level of fitness. So I remember the last day, like the end of June, we were doing, or by the time we first came back in, we were doing 4 1-mile runs within 6 minutes and a minute rest. And I was like, this is the first day of pre-season. And I'm like, we're already machines, and we were a really fit team. And I loved that anyway. And he used to pull me and say, when the fittest players bent over in pain, that's when I know I can stop. And I was like, what a mentality that is. But he, as a coach, he was absolutely brilliant. He put on really good sessions, and they'd be really meaning. I even remember one day it was absolutely lashing it down, and I was like, surely he's going to wrap this session up. And he went, listen, we can't get any wetter. And I just kind of laughed and went, fair point, and then carried on training. So I knew that he had the training sessions, like I said, from defence all the way through to attack were really, really good. We became very fit, very strong, and we just became a good team. And there was some really good players around there. I remember we were playing Swansea, I think, who were league leaders at the time. And I'm sure, I think the game finished 4-2, but we went 3-0 up in like half an hour.
Yeah.
And we battered them, took the game to them, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, I remember that. And there was a game against Nottingham Forest, I think, as well, during that time. And it felt like we were really starting to build up momentum and fighting with the big clubs of our division, and Six Wheels was buzzing and everything was great. We finished ninth in your second season. Yeah, momentum's really starting to build. 2008-2009 though, things started to unravel a little bit. A lot of injuries, a lot of loanees coming in and out from what I remember, and then we end up getting relegated. Can you put your finger on what it was that went so wrong between the two seasons?
I don't know. I think again, a few players had left. I think a couple of players got sold and moved on. Fair play to them. Absolutely right. They should do that. I remember looking at the fixtures on the start of the season, and we had Leeds, obviously, last game of the season. I was like, imagine if we need to beat Leeds to get promoted or get in the playoffs, or even worse, get relegated. And you never thought that is what would happen, but it just seemed to go that way the season. It was a frustrating one. I don't think we was even in the bottom four for that long, if not just the last game of the season. And I remember, weirdly, we played MK Dons, and the game got postponed because of bad weather at halftime. And I remember walking off and getting into the change rooms going, oh, I think we could have done all right there. And even the replay, I still remember a corner in like the 85th, 86th minute. And I'm going, if we score here, we're safe. We're going to be all right. And the ball came in, obviously it didn't happen, and finished the game with the point, and I think we might have lost 1-0. Either way, we weren't safe, and I knew we had to go to Elland Road on the Saturday, and on the Thursday we had our end of season awards due, and I was like, you're trying to get your mindset and you're going, this should not be now, it should be further down. And even the gaffer Stuart was going, you know, we've got a team here that's going to go to Leeds and do something, and we were confident we were going to do something, but it's a big stadium ground to go to, you know, there's going to be a sellout there. So it was just a difficult, see, frustrating. Again, like I said, the season before, to finish ninth and be there or thereabouts, knocking on the door of the playoffs, to then get relegated the next season, it's just frustrating, really frustrating. Look back on it and difficult. I remember one of my best friends from when I was 10, 11 years old, we were at Stockport Boys. Andy Hughes played at Leeds that day. I remember seeing him in the tunnel and speaking to him afterwards. And yeah, it was just a sad way to go after such a promising season, the one before.
That last day at Leeds, I think that Milton Keynes game that you mentioned was on the Tuesday night just before, wasn't it? So you would have had that in the midweek before. And I think if we'd have got a point, we would have been fine and stayed up. And
yeah,
everything would have been fine. So we go into the last game, still a couple of places above the bottom four. We knew that even if we lost, we still needed results to go against us fairly badly to go down. I remember being in the corner of that ground thinking, something's got to go terribly wrong for us to get relegated. I think Carlisle needed to beat Millwall. Millwall were going for the playoffs. Carlisle were right down the bottom. And weirdly, like Brighton had to beat Stockport. It seems incredible to say that now, but Brighton had to beat Stockport for us to drop down a couple of places. On days like that, how aware are you as players of what's going on, especially in a stadium like that? Because Leeds fans were obviously getting all the messages. They were taunting us. They were shouting at us that we're going down. How aware are you of other things going on at that point?
Again, you don't really pick much up from the crowd, no matter how big it was. It was obviously tens of thousands there that day at Elland Road. And I just remember one point where I saw the Cobblers fans cheering, and I was like, something good must have happened. And I think it was either misinformation or we thought someone had scored, but it was actually Carlisle that had scored.
Yeah.
So we had a cheer going, because I think we were losing the game at the time. And I was like, we need someone to help us, and just this once, please. And like I said, we heard the cheer thinking, maybe it's got to be something positive, but obviously it wasn't the right information, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. Everyone thought Carlisle had scored. I mean, again, it's what, 10, 11, 12, 13, whatever years later it is, I can't keep up. You look back on it and you think, how is that misinformation getting through? But you just haven't got the same stuff as you has now. Like these days, everyone would have pretty much watching their games on their phone, right? Or watching the other game as it goes. Wow. But it was just mad, the amount of mixed messages that was going on, and suddenly it's like dawning on you what's happening. And Leeds are obviously going for the playoffs that year, and they're not letting up at all. I think they'd beaten us in the cup replay 5-2 as well. So not a good time at all. But Stuart Gray then lasts only until September of the next season. Samo comes in. Did you think, firstly, Stuart, if Stuart had stayed, if we had stayed up, do you think, given the chance, he would have been able to turn it around again in League One?
I would have thought so. I mean, like I said, he'd obviously proven himself and he had a track record there and he brought the best out of us. But again, though, football's so fickle. Managers don't get time in it. Even moving forward past Samo's time, when Samo went, even that, you look back and go, I think it was only 7 games previous or maybe 8 games that we'd beat Liverpool. So it is a fickle, fickle world. So I think the gaffer Stuart would have been able to turn it around, but unfortunately you just don't get that time.
At the end of that season, you've turned down the contract as well initially, and then a few weeks later signed one again. What went on during that time? Did you have other options? What kind of was going on during that few weeks?
Yeah, I had other options, and I always thought I'd stay at Northampton. That would be me to the end of my career. And it just came about that, I think contract-wise, I got offered a lot less than what I was on. I was like, I understand where the club's coming from, but I also need to see what's best for me as well. I remember, I think it was Lincoln had put an offer in. So I was driving up from Northampton to go to Lincoln, and Samo rang me. And I'm literally not even on the M1 yet. And he said, listen, we've got a bit of a more improved offer. Do you want to come and have a look at it? And I was like, yeah. Because for the fact that my family were in Northampton now, my kids were at school, the drive to Lincoln enough was a pain in the backside. And to be doing that every day at my age, I wanted to be as close to a club as possible. So it would be moving up there, moving the family up there. So I went and saw Samuel that day and signed the contract. And the rest was history.
It's so funny you say that about Lincoln, because if I had to think about any other club that would have been in for you that during that time, the way that they played, Lincoln would have been the ones.
Yes.
I would have just loved it. Loved that throw in itself. But so glad you stayed. I'm sure you're glad you stayed as well, because a few months later, Anfield, that famous win, even getting to Anfield, the wins that we had along the way to get there.
Yeah.
But as a Man United fan, to go and play at Anfield first, but also to go and win there, how sweet did that feel?
Do you know what? I look back at Northampton, we always seem to get good cup games, and every season. I mean, we played Baltimore in the Premier League, Sunderland in Middlesbrough, etc. Great stadiums. And then the first couple of rounds, I remember we beat Millwall at home. So they were in League One at the time, we were League Two. And then the next round, we had Reading, and Reading away. There's one of my favourite stories in football. It's only relevant to me, but I can tell you, and it's one of those where, I mean, I'd scored in the game with my right foot. So it was a weird night anyway. That never, ever happens. But we got through to extra time, and I think they were 3-2 up, and it was literally the 120th minute, and the ball's been played over the top, and Shane Long was playing up front for there, and he's obviously rapid, and he's gone into the box, and I've tried to win the ball. I actually have tried to win the ball, and I've just clicked his ankles, and it's rolled out for a goal kick, and it's the most obvious penalty in the world for me. And the referee's kind of looked at his watch and went, goal kick, because we're going to lose the game. We obviously then kick it up the field, someone gets a flick on, and Alex scores to make it 3-3. We beat them on penalties then. And then after the game, we get drawn against Liverpool. I was like, that's something that it could have easily been a penalty, lose the game 4-2, and we never played Liverpool at Anfield. So I always look back at the moment going, someone was looking over me or something was looking over me that minute to go, let's just give a goal kick because they're going to lose anyway. And then to go and get the equaliser was just crazy. But then obviously all the build-up to the Liverpool game was coming around, which was, again, just being a United fan, I was dreaming about it going, we're playing at Anfield, and if we could win, imagine if we could win. Because you think... It's great. Well, we'll have a lovely day out, but we're going to get beat because the Liverpool, they're in the Premier League, we're in League Two. And then you go out. I remember walking out onto the grass and I was like, this is the greenest grass I've ever seen in my life. It's just a different colour green. And the setting was there. And we went 1-0 down after 7 minutes. And I was like, this is going to be a really long night. But then playing against Premier League teams, they do back off. They give you time to play. So we managed to, we had some decent technical footballers in there. So we started to pass the ball around. Then we got to 1-1. And then it goes to extra time. And you're like, this is madness. We're taking Liverpool to extra time. And we go 2-1 up. And you're thinking, this is it. We're done. And then obviously the equalised in, like, I think the 119th, 120th minute, you're thinking, that's our chance gone. So I remember going to the, because I was captain on the day, and going to the halfway line to do the toss for penalties. And then we obviously got them at the cop end, and I was like, oh. And then Stevie Guinan, I remember it was absolutely lashing it down. Yeah. Stevie Guinan blazes the first one over, and you're like, oh, we were so close. And then obviously things transpired, and luckily Abdul Osman was the coolest man, and against Reading as well, because I was next in line at Reading and next in line at Liverpool. Man. So I was like, I've never been so frightened on a level where you go, I'm obviously not going to die, but fear-wise, the stomach, the I'm like, I just need him to score. And yeah, thankfully, he was cool as a cucumber. Set the keeper the wrong way. And then I remember we ran to him, and then we all ran the length of the pitch and just dived and did a massive slate. It was just amazing, amazing scenes.
It was so surreal, watching it from the other end. You don't really soak it in as a fan until a lot later on as to what's happening. She's just full of adrenaline. Was that, I guess that was the same for the players as well.
There was so many weird things happened. I got sent a clip of Alan McAnally, who did the penalties on Sky, and he was like, if Abdul Osman scores, Northampton beat Liverpool. And he turned around and goes, he scored, and he's nearly crying because we beat Liverpool. And then weirdly enough, that summer I'd met Phil Neal on holiday. He was staying in the same hotel as me. So I spoke to him, and I didn't realise he was from Northampton, went to Liverpool. And then after the game, we're sat on the coach waiting to go, and he comes on the coach. And I'm like, and he's asked for me. So I've walked down the front. I've gone, how are you doing? Are you okay? Because obviously I met him and his family, and he met my family. He was like, what a fantastic game that was. I'm going, this is the weirdest night of my life. And then I remember, because I think they were sponsored by Carlsberg at the time, and they gave us like 10 crates of Carlsberg, and on the way back I think I might have had one or two beers, because you were just stood there going, or sat there going, speaking to your mates with the biggest stupid grin on your face going, what has just happened? And then very, very surreal, but amazing.
Do any of the Liverpool players or Roy come in and say anything to you in the changing room or anything? Are any of them coming in, or are they just off doing their own thing?
No, I think it was one of those where we stayed out on the pitch for that long, celebrating with all the conference fans, which was amazing. Yeah. And then, as soon as I got back in as well, I got pulled by Sky or BBC, and I was doing interviews, and it was probably half an hour, 40 minutes after the game that I even got into our dressing room, because you just, the elation of everything, and then you see your teammates and you just giggling, laughing, going, what is this that we have just done there? Even then, you're just laughing, because you're going, if you try and register what you've actually done, you go, well, that's not clearly possible, and you go, well, it's just happened. So it's amazing.
Incredible stuff, and almost makes it even more baffling that summer didn't last too long afterwards. It lasted until the following March. There was a few draws in a row. I mean, things weren't going amazingly, but it wasn't a disaster what was going on. So a bit of a shock to everyone. Same for you as players, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think on the Saturday we played Bradford at home, and I think we beat them 2-0. And to be fair, it was one of the most comfortable games. I was thinking their team talk must have been quite easy. You know, they've just beat Liverpool. They're going to be resting on the laurels. We'll get at them, etc. Get fans on the back. And it just felt like a really comfortable game. And then I think the next five games, we drew all of them or something like that. It was either five or six games. And it depends whether your glass is half full or half empty, because you go, well, we're unbeaten in five or six, or we've not won in five or six. And then we lost the next game. So it was then we'd not won in six or seven. So then obviously Samo went in. And again, that's just where it shows how fickle football is. You look at it and go, it seemed a bit harsh, incredibly harsh. Like I said, considering the success of one of the biggest nights ever for Northampton, beat Liverpool, and seven games later, you're on your way. So, it was a bit of a shock, that one.
So, finishing up with the Cobblers, you've worked under some, I've got to choose my words carefully, big character managers. Firstly, Gary Johnson. What was Gary like to work with?
Gary was a funny, funny guy. It's one of those where Gary was definitely Marmite. He was, I remember at one point where we had a golf day at Collingtree, and we played in this golf day, and the gaff said, come along and play, so because I love my golf, and so I played. And then afterwards he said, do you want to be first team coach? He went, I can speak to you and you're good relaying messages to the team. And I was like, yeah, this is like my route into management. But I could see how he would definitely wind people up, because he was just a small firework. So he would go off at any time. And again, he wasn't bothered if the fans loved him or hated him. He was there to do his job, and that's how he saw it. So he didn't worry about, like I said, upsetting anybody. He's there to do a job and very, very focused. So I can absolutely see why you said he's a big character.
Yeah. Your last manager as well, Eddie Boothroyd, comes in. At the time he comes in, we bottom of the Football League, like staring relegation in the face, takes us up to 20th. And you leave at the end of the 2011-12 season. So that would have been just before he progresses that and takes us to the playoffs, before it goes quite wrong for him. But I mean, Clark Carlisle speaks so highly of AD. What did you take from him as a player?
Yeah, I thought he was brilliant. He got rid of me, and he did a few things that that I definitely was like, oh, he's just doing that to wind me up. He didn't want me to play. But for me, I thought he was brilliant. His coaching sessions were planned out every single day. And every morning, you'd have some managers who, if we'd lost on Saturday, would come in on a Monday sulking, genuinely sulking, and wouldn't want to speak to you. Whereas AD was brilliant every Monday morning. He's like, the game's gone, we'll watch it, we'll, you know, go through it, here's what we can do better, but always super, super positive. And so, yeah, I can say all really good words for him. I thought he was brilliant. And even the next season, I did a lot of commentary on the radio, which I loved, for the Cobblers games. And I managed to do the game at Wembley, and I was down pitside and spoke to him before the game. And he was just, again, smiling his face, very calm, and did brilliant things. It just obviously didn't work out for him in the end.
Yeah, so you leave at the end of 2011-12, close to 200 appearances for the club, comfortably the longest you've been with one club as well. Some clear highlights in there. Would Anfield, you'd have to say, is your highlight as your time with the Cobblers?
Yeah, absolutely. But like I said, it was brilliant, because we had Bolton at the Reebok when they were in the Premier League, and we beat them 2-1. Bayo scored two, and I've still got Kevin Davies' shirt from that night. And I had, weirdly enough, I'm from Stockport, but there's a group of friends, and there's like four or five who are Bolton fans. So they were all there on the night. I remember playing Sunderland at their place, and again we were 1-0 up, I think it was, and then I'm pretty sure we went 2-0 up, which was the worst thing we could do, because at 1-0 they weren't really pushing. At 2-0 they had to go for it, and I remember the keeper coming up for corners, I think, and I think we might have lost the game on penalties in the end, and that's when Roy Keane was manager. And then after the game, he was stood outside our dressing room and shaking all our hands, saying how well we played. And I always remember his interview afterwards. And the interview could obviously see that he was fuming, which is not like Roy Keane, because he normally smiles a lot. But he was genuinely fuming. And they're like, you know, but obviously you came back from a losing deficit. You know, you must take some positives from there. And he was like, no positives whatsoever. That's the worst game of football I've ever been involved in. And I was like, I love hearing that. So, yeah, we had some really, really good nights on the road.
Nice. So after your career ending, you actually ended up working with John Brady a little bit for his soccer school. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I went to Corby for a couple of weeks because Samuel was the manager, and he just said, come along and see how you get on. And to be fair, I'd had six of the operations at Northampton, one each season, and my knee was just in pain. So I did literally a week or two training. I was like, I can't play. I need to call it a day. Which is sad, because I felt really, really fit, but my knee was just giving me too much grief. So I then went to saw John and went with his back of the net coaching company, which I loved. I always thought if I wasn't a footballer, I'd be a teacher, because I love going into schools, coaching everyone. And I remember we'd go around different schools in the Northampton area, and I had like these 4 and 5 year olds, and I always, with my kids as well, I always like either do maths or questions on capital cities to get them. So I was like to the kids, I said, right, whoever gets this right gets to be captain for the day. And I said, what's the capital of England? And all of them shouted E. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, you're all brilliant, you're all captains. So yeah, I loved it. It was great, because John was obviously the Brackley manager at the time as well. And just great to see how he's come on and doing so well at the minute.
That wasn't how Courtney Herbert came about, was it? He didn't go into a school before Anfield and say,
Courtney Herbert was one of the most frustrating players. I'm sure we played.
Is he it did, Buckby? Yeah.
Not Buckby. I don't know what they called it, where he came from. I can't remember the club. But we must have played him in pre-season. Then he came and I was like, he's so genuinely lightning, and he'd do something sublime and then something terrible. I remember when we played the Reading game before the Liverpool game, I think it was Liam Rossini was playing left back, and he just ran him ragged all night. And I was like, he's got so much potential. But yeah, it wasn't one of my coaching projects.
round off your career then. A couple of quick fire questions. Favourite manager you worked under?
Difficult, that one. I'll probably say John Gorman and Brian Little. Very, very similar, very nice. And then to the other extreme, you had the likes of Gary Johnson and Neil Warnock, which were different experiences.
You've definitely been to both extremes. I mean, ones. Favourite Cobblers player to room with over your years?
Sam Aston. I'm still in touch with Sam now. Yeah, I remember when I was at Shrewsbury on loan briefly, Sam was there. And then it was 4 years later that I signed for Northampton. And the day I signed in the car park, he's pulled up and he's gone, "Have you signed?" I was like, "Yeah." So we just hit it off from there. And like I said, still in touch with Sam now.
Nice. He went into teaching as well, didn't he? Afterwards.
He is. He's a head teacher now.
He's a
very loud Geordie guy who... I don't know if I can say Geordie because, yeah, he's a Northampton, Newcastle fan, but he's a super intelligent guy. Lovely, lovely guy.
Nice, good stuff. Coming on to the match on Sunday then, 3 p.m. kickoff at Six Fields for the Legends game. Looking forward to it?
Very much so, yeah. There's quite a few players that were there, obviously, during my time that I've not seen for a while, so looking forward to catching them all.
Yeah, fancy your chances. Have you had a chance to look at your squads, or have you been sent the squads yet to compare? I've not yet.
I saw obviously Bayo posted a video that he's coming along, and I was really excited because I've not seen Bayo for a long time. And then I thought, he needs to be on my team, because if he's not, I'm probably going to be marking him. And I did that and it still haunts me. He's still the strongest man in the world, so I'm hoping he's on our team.
It doesn't look like it. I've seen the lineups on Facebook this week. You've been split into two squads. It looks like Bayo has been added to the other team, but who knows?
I'm playing left wing then.
You can probably try and persuade him before. you've got some good targets up there. So you've got Josh Lowe on your team, by the looks of it. Abdul's on your team, so you might be able to take the pressure off again. Chris Yargreaves, Courtney's on your team, actually, so you might be able to send him off down the wing. So, yeah, it should be a really good occasion. Apart from yourself, who do you think, you've said you've seen some of the names, who do you think are going to be the ones to watch? Who do you think still got it from that list?
I think you've got Ryan Gilligan. His name was mentioned. I think he was on there. Luke was on there. Luke was one of those players when he was with us. Luke Gustrich, if he's on there. He was technically brilliant, and he had the strongest, weakest foot I've ever seen. So his left foot shot was like an absolute missile. So I think there's a few out there that are still going to be technically good. I just don't think we're all going to be able to cover the ground as much as we used to.
Yeah, I think that's why the squads are so big. I'm imagining it's going to be some sort of rolling sub situation.
I hope so.
But no, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time out. I know it's a work day for you, so thank you for coming on and chatting to us. Really appreciate it. All the best for Sunday.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Nice one. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Tickets are still on sale for Sunday now from ntfcdirect.co.uk. Game's helping to raise funds for the NTFC Community Trust, so do go on down there if you can. Hopefully see as many of you there as possible. Thanks again to Andy, and we'll see you again soon.
Hey, there's the cup. There's the pictures you'll see on tomorrow's back pages. The Cobblers are going through into Division 1. Bring them on, because we deserve it.
Sports Social Podcast Network.